Welcome to the Gala Government Shutdown edition of It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elvey.
And until Friday night, I'm Ken Rudin.
That's right, Ken. I'm very sorry to hear that you're going to be expiring at midnight tomorrow night.
First of all, the federal government does supply NPR with 2% of our funding, so 2% of the funny jokes will be missing from this week's podcast if there is a shutdown.
See, I thought we were just going to eliminate your portion of the podcast.
But, you know, we should point out is that we're doing this podcast on Thursday morning, so we really don't know what's going to happen.
Thursday, but actually, April 7th,
But we do know what's going to happen, because I think we know basically what's going to happen.
Live in infamy. We know what's going to happen. Yeah. We've known for months what's going to happen. They're going to come right to the brink, and then, Hosanna, they will emerge in the White House driveway and announce they have all come together, and that for the good of our troops and for the good of America and to keep the planes flying, we are going to have a deal not have a shutdown.
Well, we're certain about that because, first of all, the Republicans know what happened to them in 95 and 96. They got blamed for the shutdown.
And Clinton got reelected.
It helped Bill Clinton. And we don't want Barack Obama to win a second term, and therefore we can't give him ammunition to run against us.
So we know better than to shut the government down. We'll go right to the brink. We'll ask for more cuts. We'll ask for a lot of policy riders. We'll ask for an end to Planned Parenthood and an end to NPR and an end to a lot of other things. But we'll step back at the last moment and declare victory.
Exactly.
Yes, that's what we'll do.
Because we still got $33 billion in cuts, and we still have the Paul Ryan thing to worry about in 2012. We'll worry about that part after we get through this the next couple of months.
So there won't be a government shutdown, and we knew it all along.
You know, Ron, there is, on the other hand, of course, they could have a shutdown. And we knew that. We knew they would.
You know what? You know what? This time is different.
Yeah.
This time is different. And as we've been saying pretty much for months, this is not 1995. Newt Gingrich is not the speaker. We don't have a speaker who's going to be out there making it all about him
The polls show the Democrats could take a hit as well.
That's
so
right. The
I
polls are showing sides. It's pretty much evenly balanced. So as we've said
that's
along,
that's what we knew.
This is the time the shutdown really happens.
Right, exactly. And so that's it for this week's political podcast. No, actually, so which shows that we don't know what we're talking about, but nor does anybody
else.
And
that was really in dispute. That was really in doubt. There were a lot of people waiting to have that shown.
The person.
Oh, I'm sorry. The listener has been wondering, will it ever really be shown that they just don't know what
they're
talking
about? We've shown them.
This is the week. All right.
But look, just listen to Harry Reid in the last couple of hours. Again, we're doing this on Thursday morning, but last night, Wednesday night, he said he's comfortable that we'll have a deal. And then on Thursday morning, he says,
the numbers are extremely close. Our differences are no longer over how much savings we get on government spending. The only thing holding up an agreement is ideology.
Well, the Republicans are putting up these ideological roadblocks with abortion riders and Planned Parenthood.
Well, they have put a number of issues onto the budget here that clearly would.
They Republicans.
That is correct.
Yeah.
That the president is clearly going to veto. And perhaps the strategy here is to make the president cast a veto to cause the shutdown.
And he's responsible.
That's right.
Yeah, but President Clinton
did the veto in
1995.
But the temperature has changed in the country, and many of the people on the House Republican side, and we're talking here about many freshmen and some Tea Party-affiliated people who are not freshmen and some freshmen who are not Tea Party-affiliated, all of whom feel like the game has changed. The country has come to a new appreciation of what the choices are and that the debt and the deficit, the annual deficit, at $1.5 trillion is just a totally different animal from what it was in 1995, and there's real truth in that.
Michael Gerson in the Washington Post this week talked about how basically President Obama has already won because he has exposed differences in the Republican Party. I would make the case that the Republicans have already won because now we're talking about, well, is it $33 billion we're taking out through September 30th, or is it $40 billion? Already, that's far better than the Republicans ever thought they'd have, and far worse than Harry Reid ever thought he'd consider.
That's right. The entire discussion is, of course, about cutting spending. There is no discussion whatsoever about raising taxes or increasing revenues in any way. We are on utterly Republican territory in almost this entire discussion, and that all works as a kind of segue to the 2012 budget. And again, everything we're talking about here with respect to the shutdown is 2011
budget. September 30th, right.
And it ends, the fiscal year ends in September. So we are at the same time on a separate track, on a parallel track, talking about a budget for next year. And here, the lead has very much been seized by the House Budget Chairman, Paul Ryan of Wisconsin, who has come forward with a rather remarkable budget document.
It is not just a budget, it is a cause.
Remarkable in that it is such a four-square return to Reaganism plus.
Reaganism? How about Hooverism?
Well, no, seriously. It is really going back a very great distance. Ronald Reagan lowered tax rates substantially, but never dreamed of getting it down to a top rate of 25%. Well, this budget is 25%.
He lowered tax rates until he raised taxes the next year.
Yeah, well, he raised taxes and then he lowered them again in 1986. Okay. But at that point, they were very proud of getting down to a 28% top rate. This is 25% for individuals, 25% for corporations. And it deeply slashes virtually everything else in the budget other than defense
and
literally takes, yes, it does set Social Security aside, but he does do this one thing that I think has gotten him universal kudos and real salutes from virtually everyone, which is he does not say we can do all this by eliminating waste, fraud, and abuse. And he doesn't say that the deficit is going to go away. What he says is we need to keep taxes low and we need to slash all these other programs and we need to reduce the deficit. It doesn't actually get to zero until something like 2040 in his budget plan. But what he thinks we need to do is admit we can't afford Medicare.
The open-ended, blank-check nature of Medicare's subsidy mechanism is threatening the solvency of this critical program, and it is creating inexcusable levels of waste in the system.
And that alone is such a stunning thing for a politician to do when that is one of the most popular programs the federal government
has. So it's either amazingly courageous, amazingly bold, amazingly far-seeking, or it's political suicide, because all you have to do is just mention Medicare is being privatized and something like that, and that's a 30-second commercial about the Democrats.
I think that's true, but I think the Republicans here again, like with the shutdown on the 2011 budget, are gambling that the country is ready for somebody to step up and say, we cannot have a program of uncontrolled cost growth with the baby boom retiring and so on. So 10 years from now, we're going to cut off Medicare as a defined benefit. We're going to say, no, the government doesn't cover all your bills when you're sick, when you're retired and over 65. We're only going to help you buy conventional health insurance, just like younger people have to buy. And we're not going to help you that much in doing that. We're going to greatly reduce the cost of older people's medical bills to the government. Now, whether or not that means older people have no more illness or no more high cost of illness or that they can suddenly get insurance cheaply, well, that's just going to have to be worked out in the private market. And Paul Ryan and the Republicans have confidence that that will work out well.
Well, you can say that the American people are crying out for some kind of solution, not the nickel and diming that we've been doing for years. And this is a major, major attack on this problem. And you can also say that President Obama has not done likewise. You could say, well, Ryan is so crazy, unlike the Obama plan. What Obama plan?
That's
there
right.
Is no sacrifice. There's no corresponding offer by the Obama and the Democrats on what to do about this. But here's the problem. The problem is, if you talk about courage, then you go to Simpson-Bowles debt commission
the president's debt commission that he appointed.
But, I mean, for all the radical proposals coming from Paul Ryan, it still does not touch revenue. It does not touch the wealthy. It does not touch Social
defense.
Security. It does not touch defense.
And it doesn't balance the budget.
Other than the $78 billion that President Obama has already agreed to cut from defense, and it doesn't lower the deficit.
It lowers the deficit.
Somewhat, yeah.
But it does not eliminate the deficit or really reduce the effect of the deficit for a number of years.
But do the Republicans get heralded or criticized because they come up with such a bold plan, or do the Democrats get heralded or criticized by coming up with nothing?
I think the Republicans get both heralded and respected and saluted, and then also they get clobbered because what they're proposing is going to be very unpopular. The Democrats,
and it won't get anywhere in the Democratic Senate, nor will it pass President Obama.
That's right. And President Obama, in this instance, as with the 2011 budget shutdown drama, is essentially standing on the sidelines. He's in the wings. He's saying, gee, those Republicans and Democrats really ought to work out their differences, as though he weren't one or the other, as though he weren't in league with the Democrats. And of course he is. But what he is really thinking about here is how does he distance himself from the messiness and the ugliness and the partisanship of what's going on in Congress and run for re-election as being above the fray to some degree.
Similar to what Clinton did in 96.
That's right. And that's why the Republicans would like to force him to veto what they could get through Congress. The problem with that is in 95 and 96, the Republicans in the House had allies in the Senate. They had the control of the Senate. Now they don't. So if they can't pass something and force Obama to veto it, how exactly do we join this battle? They can't get to Obama until they get through the Democratic Senate. That's their problem, and that's what they haven't worked out. That's why we'll probably be at this shutdown brink, not only this week, but probably again and again on the debt ceiling, on the 2012 budget. I suspect we're coming back to this point regularly.
Well, how much of this is a true desire by the Republicans to have budget reduction, and how much of this is an ideological test of who blinks first? And
similar, I don't see why those are mutually exclusive.
They may not be.
The Republicans want both. They want the ideological clash. They want the confrontation. And they also want to shrink the government and shrink the cost.
And that's what we saw in Wisconsin, too, with Scott Walker. We saw that in states like Ohio with John Kasich, Indiana with Mitch Daniels. Basically, they do feel that, look, state governments cannot afford to keep spending the way they're spending. But at the same time, there is an ideologically driven, you can make the case that, look, let's punish the unions who tried to punish us in 2010. I mean, who went after Scott Walker more than anybody else except the public employee unions in the election of 2010? So they went after the Scott Walkers and they went after the John Kasichs. And now that Walker and Kasich and company have won, they're saying, well, wait a second, you know, we could have some retribution here.
Well, it's really all adding up to being one of the most political non-election years we've ever seen. It's an odd-numbered year, and yet it feels like an election year already. Here we are in April. And Wisconsin, as you mentioned, has really become ground zero. Yes, Indiana, yes, Ohio, Illinois, other places this battle is being joined. But Wisconsin has really become ground zero, not only because Paul Ryan, the bold and visionary and Medicare-killing House budget chairman, is from Wisconsin, but because of Scott Walker, the governor you mentioned, and because the fight over the collective bargaining rights of public employee unions in Wisconsin is going to the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, and they just happened by chance to have an election this week, a regularly scheduled election, for one of the justices of the Wisconsin State Supreme Court. These are elected offices in Wisconsin.
A 10-year term.
And after a long term, David Prosser, very conservative Republican, very conservative justice
again,
on that
court. It's a nonpartisan race, but we know he used to be the Republican.
He was a state legislator.
He was the Speaker of the State Assembly.
And he was a very hard-edged Republican when he was in the legislature and appointed by Tommy Thompson, the governor, to the court. And he represents the 4-3 majority the Republicans have there. So normally, one would have expected him to be rather easily reelected,
although
it's always a vote, but it's usually not a tough vote, and there's usually not a first-class challenger.
Let's just go back to February when the initial election happened. David Prosser got
in the primary.
It was not a primary thing. It's basically to see who the final two will go on to the general election. And David Prosser got 55% of the vote. Joanne Kloppenburg got 25% of the vote.
But that was February.
That was February, exactly.
Since then, the earth has opened.
Before this became the Spanish Civil War, this is a proxy battle over what Scott Walker was doing.
And that it is now. And, of course, in the vote on Tuesday, almost 1.5 million Wisconsinites went to the polls.
I think more than that. Extraordinary turnout.
What I saw was just under 1.5 million in this race.
Right.
There may have been more voting in local elections and so on. But in this race, almost 1.5 million votes cast. A third of the state voted. I mean, that's good turnout in an even number of years.
70% in Madison, I saw.
Yes. And, of course, that's a highly politicized state capital, university town. But the vote, after all those votes, is down to 204 in the first tally. That is 0.01% separating
the
two
candidates. Kloppenburg,
Joanne Kloppenburg,
Democrat/liberal/anti-Walker, whatever you want to call her, the point is she has a lead, and whether she ultimately wins or not, because obviously this will go to a recount, but it just shows how split in two, the state is over what Scott Walker is trying to accomplish.
And I would argue that Wisconsin...
And how much money, the millions of dollars that went into that unbelievable that election.
Because, again, as you say, it's become the Spanish Civil War, the sort of prelude to the greater conflict to come. And I would argue that Wisconsin is a pretty good cross-section of the country in many respects. It doesn't have the minority population that other states have, some other states have, but it has generally been something of a bellwether state for national attitudes towards the kind of issues that we're talking about, size of government, role of government, role of unions in politics. So it's going to be very closely watched, and not just because it makes an extraordinary show, but also because it really has meaning for the whole country.
You said that this is only 2011, a reminder of 2012, but we did get a reminder this week of 2012. Announced his candidacy for president?
It was not exactly what you'd call the world's grandest announcement. They put it out essentially.
Who's what's his name?
The guy's got the job now. Barack Obama.
Barack Obama.
And he put out a video, or sort of a message to his supporters, very low-key sort of.
Well, he wasn't even in it.
I don't agree with Obama on everything, but I respect him and I trust him.
You know, this is a strange presidential cycle that we're in. It's a bit of a throwback, like some of the other things that are happening in our politics. The president backs in with this kind of odd little video. Of course, everybody knew he was running for re-election.
Right.
But still, usually, you get a little bit grander, more imperial sort of statement from a sitting president. At the same time, the Republican field, which we all expected to be really quite roiling and rollicking by now, isn't showing a lot of signs of life. In fact, the first debate that was going to be officially sponsored by the Republican Party has now been postponed all the way to
September. Yeah.
Now, as we all remember, 4 years ago when we were going into the 2008 cycle, the Democrats were debating by spring of 2007.
Republicans too.
And the Republicans as well.
We had 20 candidates in by this time 4 years ago, right?
And they were campaigning in conventional ways in the early primary states. We're not seeing as much of that this time around. People are holding back.
You know what I think it is? I think they don't know, well, neither the Democrats nor the Republicans, especially the Republicans, don't know if this is 2008 or 2010. I mean, of course, it's 2012, but it's 2011 going. Okay, I know.
Now, that wasn't confusing.
No.
I can't imagine why they're confused.
But I know what I actually meant was, is this the anti-Republican year of 2008, which was anti-Bush, anti-pasta, we always say, the reaction to Katrina?
You always say.
But, I mean, there's no Iraq war. I mean, this was the whole kind of thing that drove out the Republicans in 2006 and 2008. And then, lo and behold, just 2 years later,
boom,
we saw
back.
Complete turnabout, and then when it was the Democrats who were the bad guys, the Democrats who were fumbling and not doing well.
Yeah, but I understand that. So if you're trying to decide what kind of campaign you want to run in 2012, and you're a Republican, you want to know whether it's going to be 08 or it's going to be 10. But at the same time, you got to get out there and get running whatever kind of year it's going to be. You have to take your chances. You have to gamble. You have to say, I'm out there. I'm in the field. I'm running. And show yourself.
Yes, yes. And the last time I showed myself, there was a cop at my door a few minutes later. But here's the thing. Go back to 1991, and this may not be a good example, but I remember a Newsweek cover where they were talking about the
Newsweek?
Right, remember that? Let alone the cover.
Cover?
But they were talking about, basically, the Democrats had just endorsed George H.W. Bush and just forget about
just
it.
Just give it
and
up.
And punt to 96.
That's right. That's right, after the Iraq War.
Yeah, exactly.
And well, he was at 90% for a day or two.
And Bill Clinton didn't announce, I think, until the fall of 91.
Right. And other people that folks thought might run didn't announce
the
at all.
The Al Gore, the Dick Eppart, exactly, the people like that. So I'm thinking that maybe Republicans waiting until September after Labor Day is not the worst thing in the world. Of course, you do have the impending Iowa and New Hampshire votes in February, not January anymore. But I think it's okay. I don't know. I don't think they know how to approach them because they felt very buoyed by what happened in 2010, and yet they still know that Obama has tremendous advantages. One, financial, and two, that I don't think the country really just has soured on him the way the Republicans thought they did in 2010.
Well, he's running at about 49% approval, which has been kind of normative for a period of time.
Far better than Ronald Reagan in 1983.
Who was, I believe, in the high 30s at the comparable point, better than Jimmy Carter before he lost his reelection bid. But not that different from, say, George W. Bush, right, at a comparable point in his presidency. So I think it's very much an open question,
yeah,
how strong Obama looks for next year, except that we know he seems to have the ability to raise $1 billion, and that is a rather impressive hurdle for anyone planning to run against him. There is, though, this phenomenon of the nature of the Republican field. We talked about this on an earlier podcast. We ran through an entire list of 15 candidates, a couple of whom have since taken themselves out of consideration as though they were really in it. And this is not an impressive field. It has a front runner, but people are not impressed with the front runner. And in a poll that was taken in New Hampshire this past week, Mitt Romney, that putative front runner, was still a little over 20%. This is, we're talking now about Republican preferences, strictly Republican voters. But tied for second with Mike Huckabee was Donald Trump, who has lately been making noises about running and making a lot of noises about the president's birth certificate.
He's always been making noises.
And, you know, never taken seriously in any political circles, possibly if he was talking about running for something in New York, but certainly not as a national figure. What's that about?
It's a look. We have seen this before. Do you remember?
We have seen this before.
We have, and it, with under different iterations. For example, when Jesse Jackson was running for president in 1988, in many polls he was the front runner because everybody knew Jesse Jackson. Everybody knew he would not be the Democratic nominee, but he led in some polls. After Gary Hart self-destructed in 1987, when he came back in the race in January of 88, he for a brief moment was the front runner. We all knew that was insane, but he has this national ID.
You know who else comes to mind? Leah Iacocca, who emerged as a potential presidential candidate after his years as an auto executive. And he was seen as a kind of a business genius in his day. And, you know, for a period of time, he was being taken seriously as a candidate for president. And, of course, he never ran.
Well, I don't think anybody takes Donald Trump seriously, as we said.
Including Donald Trump?
Well, not including Donald Trump. I mean, we always have said that he is the heir apparent on the Republican side, and that joke is done. Okay, well, anyway, I see our producer. Director is
she's drawing her finger sharply across her throat.
No, that was suicide. that was actually. But we should talk about before we leave, and we do have to leave. There's some Senate news of the week, and our old friend, our esteemed former colleague in the Senate, George Lemieux, yes,
from Florida.
Not only did he have a very distinguished 16 months in the Senate, but here's the key: he was appointed by Charlie Crist. And for his whole life, he will be known as the guy who Charlie Crist, that
abandoner.
Abandoner.
That independent.
That's right. The guy who sold out the Republican Party, of course. He once upon a time was a Republican in some eyes. He wasn't, and he was when he appointed George Lemieux. So Lemieux, who did establish a conservative record, he wants to run against Bill Nelson, seeking a third term next year. But Lemieux, for all his credentials, he is tied, you know, completely to Charlie Crist. He was his chief of staff, as governor, worked on his Senate campaign, appointed by him to the Senate.
But, you know, 16 months in the United States Senate, those were the good months, weren't
they?
The Lemieux months?
Oh, that's what they call them.
That's what they remember them as even today. Martin Heinrich in New Mexico. Yeah.
Martin Heinrich, this is the seat Jeff Bingaman is giving up in New Mexico. He is represents the Albuquerque area. He is the Democratic Dream candidate.
Why is he the Democratic Dream candidate?
Because he is a strong candidate. It's a swing district, but in 2010 when he was reelected, he went pretty handily. And, of course, the Republicans could be beating each other up with Heather Wilson and Lieutenant Governor Sanchez and maybe Steve Pierce.
Yeah.
So that could be tough for the Republicans to win. So good news for the Democrats there. And good news for the Democrats in Virginia. No surprise that
Tim Kaine. Yeah. No surprise, Tim Kaine.
Tim Kaine, not a surprise. He'll probably run against George Allen if George Allen survives the Republican primary. But with Tim Kaine leaving the DNC, we have a new person there.
Ted Strickland. Just the way you predicted.
Well, I was convinced it was Ted Strickland because he's from Ohio, because he didn't have a job, and because you don't need to be dynamic if your party is the one that controls the White House.
That's right. Generally speaking, the party that has the White House does not really want a dynamic spokesperson in the party chairmanship. And Ted, in a lot of ways, would have been kind of perfect, especially he's from Ohio and he could, you know,
very
he could kind of get
Obama
on TV a lot and perhaps speak for the Democrats with respect to white males and somewhat more socially conservative people and so forth.
And that Midwest battleground.
That's right. And, you know, he's kind of a pro-gun guy. So that made a certain amount of sense, and I think you were right on. You also showed that the Democrats are thinking in very different terms for 2012, because instead of all those things we just said about Ted Strickland, they went for pretty much the opposite in Debbie Wasserman Schultz. What's the profile there?
You have, first of all, somebody who's very good on television, very aggressive, a great fundraiser. And again, just like Ted Strickland could have what we represented with Ohio, Debbie Wasserman Schultz comes from Florida, another obvious 2012 battleground.
A big swing state, and one where the president is in trouble, as he is in Ohio. The numbers there are not too
good for him
either. And
who was the first female DNC chair? Named by George McGovern.
It's
Gene Westwood.
Gene Westwood. Boy, that takes me back, like, you know, like...
It's like when we met. Remember
like four the, bars
remember?
Of...
Under
of,
the dwarf maples.
Of Quicksilver Messenger Service. Okay, that's the big news in statewide races this week. Big news in political media. Fox News is parting ways with a guy who had been, well, their biggest calling card in some portion of the last 2 years, Glenn Beck.
His numbers are still good, certainly compared to
anything
his
else
rivals,
on cable,
exactly,
yeah.
CNN and MSNBC and those guys.
They're not the kind of numbers this podcast gets.
No, the number. Not
that's
numbers.
Right, the number, exactly.
But, I mean, there still has been longstanding tension between Glenn Beck and the folks at Fox News, even though though they do like controversy, sometimes he goes over the line. I think they have often been put on the defensive.
Some of the conspiracy theories, particularly about what's been going on in Libya and the Middle East and Egypt and so forth lately, kind of off the wall. I mean, not that a lot of the things he's done over the last couple of years haven't been off the wall.
No, but that drives the audience, and I think that they've been happy with the numbers, but I think sometimes he says things that crosses the line. And, you know, it's not that Fox News is suddenly wanting to move towards the middle or anything like that. They still have their conservative voices like the Hannitys and the O'Reillys and stuff like that. And Glenn Beck will still have his radio show and his newsletters and his websites and things like that. But it was surprising, given the fact that he does as well as he does, even though, albeit the numbers have not been as good lately, that he's disappearing from the daily Fox scene.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And whatever happens to the federal government, we'll be back next week.
Because we know what's going to happen.
It's all politics from NPR. Right. It's the end.
It's the end.